Hello, welcome to Overburden, the podcast for postal workers. I'm Kevin Hitchings.
And I'm Brandy Hughes. And today we are going to talk about a popular union song, including everyone's favorite, Solidarity Forever.
Yeah, if you've been to any union events, then you know Solidarity Forever. If you haven't, then you probably have no idea what we're talking about.
Possibly even like NDP rallies.
Yep. A lot of labor organizations sing Solidarity Forever as just part of their normal introduction to the day or whatever. At CUPW events, they always hand out a sheet with the song on it, and it has three versions, and they always sing verses 1 and 3, which always annoys half the people there. It's like, either sing all three or give us a sheet that only has 1 and 3. And this is a universal thing that the version CPW does has three verses, two of which are sung.
Yeah, and like I think different labor groups sing different verses, and we have ones that I know we always sing the women's one, or a version of the women's one. Yeah. I've actually seen a couple different versions of the women's verse.
The original song had six versions, and six stanzas. None of the original ones were women specific. But there are literally hundreds and hundreds of verses. I looked the song up a long time ago once, I can't remember why, and just to see all the different verses there were, and I think there was something like 200 listed on that page, and where they came from, what unions used them, and it's just, there's a huge number of variations on this, and it seemed like every union had their own personalized version of it. In case you're wondering what we're talking about still, I did search the internet for royalty-free versions of this song. It's been recorded by quite a few people: Utah Phillips, Pete Seeger, Leonard Cohen, The Night Watchman, MC Lynx, and a few other people. But I did look for royalty-free versions. I found a link to one that they claimed was royalty-free, and the guy kind of implied that he owned it, so I'm not 100% sure, but hopefully we don't get sued. I'm just going to play one verse from it, so yeah, and the chorus, so you have an idea of what we're talking about. But here's what it sounds like.
So if you're in the know, apparently that is traditionally sung to the tune of John's Brown Body or the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I wouldn't have known that had I not just read it.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone recognizes the tune, but didn't necessarily know where it came from.
Yeah, it reminds me of like when I was a kid, we would sing this song called Grapes of Wrath, and it's very similar.
Yeah, there's a few songs that are based off that tune. But the first verse is the one that pretty much is always sung. I think every version sings that first verse. And after that, it's very very customized. The one CPW sings, I'll just read it here. I won't try and sing and torture everyone with it, is, "We're the women of the union in the forefront of the fight. We know of women's issues and we know of women's rights. We're prepared to fight for freedom. We're prepared to stand our ground. Women make the union strong." And I don't know if you want to read the second verse that we never actually sing.
Yeah, it always kind of disappoints me that we never sing it. "They have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn, but without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel could turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong."
Yeah, and I really actually like that verse.
It's all the things that we're constantly fighting about.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why they always cut it out at the union events.
There are also some other verses that were added on the centennial of it, and there's specifically one that speaks to people of workers of color and immigrants, so people who speak other languages. That one goes, "They divide us by our color, they divide us by our tongue, they divide us men and women, they divide us old and young, but they'll tremble at our voices when they hear these verses sung, for the union makes us strong."
What I'd actually like to see is if we kept the first verse, or even the second verse, because, again, I really like that one, and then rotated the third one. One time it was for women, one time for First Nations people, one time it's for whatever the issue is or whatever is powerful at the time. and I'd really like to see it rotated. It's also...
I've never heard a specifically First Nations verse, but maybe there is one.
I'm sure I've seen one. It's in the front of every course binder, too. It'd be nice if there was something relevant to whatever topic they're covering at whatever convention. But again, there's hundreds and hundreds of verses to this. I would like to see them rotated just so we cover more issues and have more, a little reminder of what you're doing that day rather than just the same thing all the time. Mm-hmm. In case you hear the background noise, Brand's kids are in the next room. We usually record at the office, but sometimes it's not always convenient. So I hear some random orangutan sounds, I think.
Yeah, it's my two little monkeys. Okay, so Solidarity Forever was originally written by Ralph Chaplin in 1915 for the Industrial Workers of the World. He was kind of their poet, and he wrote a lot of pieces for them, and at one point he decided to write this.
It's included in the Little Red Songbook, it's called, which is not just him, a few other people wrote in there, but he wrote the foreword for that book, and that's where it became really widespread. They call it the Wobbly Songbook. The people in the Industrial Workers of the World union or group called Wobblies.
Yeah, just like we're called Posties, they're yeah. Wobblies.
So that's where it became famous, was spreading in the Little Red Songbook of the Wobblies.
Yeah, he reports that he began writing it in 1913 while he was a journalist covering the Paint Creek, Cabin Creek strike of 1912 in Kanawha County, West Virginia.
This was a strike that was over a year long. People were living in tents this whole time. Mm-hmm. About 20 deaths. I didn't see the breakdown of which side they were on.
I saw 50.
Oh, I saw 20 on either side, it said. So maybe they meant 20 on each side. I thought they meant 20 between the two. But could be 50.
And he finished writing it in January of 1915 when he was in Chicago. There was a hunger demonstration happening there at that time.
This is a side note. He also was a cartoonist. He did a lot of the illustrations in that book as well.
The Little Red Songbook?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Little Red Songbook is also famous for having a preamble that kind of lays out the struggle between the working class and the employer class, or the capitalists who are making all the money off of our labor.
So the preamble that he wrote in the book starts with something you probably heard. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. The class struggle will continue until the victory of the working class. Between these two classes, the struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the earth and the machinery of production, and abolish the wage system.
I like that it's not just higher wages. It's like, no, abolish the wages, like, so that we can get the actual, you know, benefits of our work.
Because as long as there's the wage system, the employer's goal is always going to be to produce the most, but give the workers the least.
Right.
And then the workers' goal is always going to be just to hang on and fight for anything we can get, which sometimes is just enough to survive. And this is a system that is obviously flawed because it's meant to create two groups with one oppressing the other.
They also call for workers to organize, so in unions, whether by all of the workers in one industry or all workers across all industries, so one giant union. So Chaplin was very clear on that rather than fighting for, you know, fair pay for a fair day's work, it should be just abolishment of the wage system.
Yeah, just really abolishment of classes in general, treating people fairly and evenly. To such an extreme, like, he really hated the industrialization of anything. And that led him to really hate the popularity of the song, even. Mm-hmm. It really blew up over the next couple of years. There's some unions that made it their official song, even, and he did not like that. He saw his song as kind of being mass-produced and pushed out as a uniform product, per se, rather than his individual music that was important to his individual cause or the cause of that strike.
It's also, like, as you noted before, different groups will sing different stanzas and leave other ones out, and it's most often that they drop the second and the fourth verse, which are actually the most use the most extreme language, they're the most
like
aggressive.
We do.
Yeah,
I think, yeah, he really thought it was diluted. Here he says, another quote from him says, "I didn't write Solidarity Forever for ambitious politicians or for job-hungry labor fakers. seeking a ride on the gravy train. All of us deeply resent seeing a song that was uniquely our own used as a singing commercial for the soft-boiled type of post-Wagner Act industrial unionism that uses million-dollar slush funds to persuade the congressional office boys to do chores for them. So really, rather than he wrote it for the grassroots is, I think, what he means there, not for large industrial unions that he sees mimicking large industrial corporations.
Yeah. Some of these quotes are taken from a later work by Ralph Chaplin entitled Why I Wrote Solidarity Forever. He says that he was kind of convinced by a colleague later in life to, after he'd written his autobiography, to add to the story a little bit by explaining why he wrote the song and how he felt it was sometimes being misused. He states that it was originally designed to meet the needs of a nonconformist, non-political labor organization that was critical of the crudely divided craft unions of the times and practiced voluntary libertarian teamwork at the point of production to obtain its objectives through the one big industrial union. He wrote it at a time when there was a life or death struggle between fiercely competitive ideological groups to see which of them would shape the future of the then embryonic left-wing labor movement. It was a knockdown, drag-out fight with no holds barred, where every available weapon from gentle persuasion to brass knuckles was used to gain a fair or unfair advantage.
And just because you mentioned the fourth verse a little earlier that he thought was one of the more powerful ones, I'm just going to read that one real quick too.
Sure.
It says, "All the world that's owned by the idle drones is ours and ours alone. We have laid the wide foundations, built it skyward, stone by stone. It is ours not to slave in, but to master and to own while the union makes us strong." So basically we build everything. We're the ones that put the work into it. We should be the ones that have some ownership and some control over it, not the corporations and the rich people who dictate what we can do, even though we did all the work. So just kind of some fair distribution of the product, I believe, of the labors rather than just the wages.
Fair distribution of the rewards, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that particularly speaks to letter carriers or to postal workers, because it often feels like we're given these jobs to do, we're kind of trained by other coworkers how to do them, and then it feels like management is just constantly coming in and changing the rules or changing the playbook
unilaterally,
and yeah, without consulting with the union, or barely consulting, or calling it consultation but really just ramming it through, and then it's up to us to make it work, and we do it, like we find ways to make it work, and we just kind of go, yeah, okay, yeah, whatever, and get it done, and then of course then when they find out you're not following their new rules, then of course they start disciplining us. But meanwhile, if we didn't do those things to make the work happen, none of it would get done. I mean, how many of us would be bringing back half our roots every day if we didn't, do the little things that make it work?
There are examples of where things aren't just a straight wage system too. Things like writers on TV shows and movies that get residuals. That product is done, it's complete, but it gets resold over and over again. And rather than the movie company or the corporation just keeping all the money, the people that actually did the work get a portion of the profits.
Yeah, the royalties. It seems similar to when they used to get the corporate team incentive, the CTI payments that stopped, when was that? Like 12 years ago?
Yeah. That's the other thing. Profit sharing is another example of this. That used to be fairly common. It was trendy. I don't know too many places that have done it anymore. And like most of them put in different wage systems that they claim are better that aren't, kind of thing, and slowly get rid of it. But and usually profit sharing was a token amount anyway compared to what the shareholders and the CEOs got. Wasn't relevant overall, but it is an example of how things should be working. And if the trend would have continued to do profit sharing rather than pulling it all back, that's another example where the workers could share the benefits of the work rather than just being disposable workers like Canada Post seems to think we are.
Right. I think I'm not going to suggest that I would like to have dividends or shares in the company in exchange for better wages, But I feel like that kind of reward system for good work, actually, it creates a lot of worker engagement, and it makes people more invested in the long-term success of whatever company they're at, because they go, oh, okay, well, if my company succeeds and we do awesome next year, I'm going to see more return on my investments that were a reward for my previous work.
Well, that's one of the problems why profit sharing kind of went away, is that corporations either just refused to raise them or slowly lowered them to the point where it's like, oh, I can work twice as hard and then I'll get $80 this year instead of 70. You know, who cares?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it has to be at a relevant level. But the point is there are methods where the workers can share in the profits or the benefits, rather than just being this a disposable workforce.
Another thing that Chapman wrote about when he was originally writing Solidarity Forever was that at the time it felt like there was a choice between taking political action at the ballot box by voting or direct action at the point of production for the attainment of immediate objectives, and secondly, a choice between armed insurrection and the general strike as a means of putting the parasite or the employer and outmoded capitalist system in its place.
And that, when you think about it, you know, the employer will argue that it's a symbiotic relationship. You know, they benefit from work we do, but really, they suck as much out of us as they can. They give as minimal back, and if they can get rid of you, they will. So I think you can't really argue that's 100% parasitic, but it's pretty much. They're just leeching off our work, and it's not like they get nothing back, so you get some wage. But, you know, it's definitely not a symbiotic relationship. It's definitely parasitic.
And I think we especially see it since the wage tiers came in, because how many times do you see them finding ways to essentially discard more experienced workers at the higher wage, because they have this attitude that, well, we can just bring in a new guy at $17 an hour and pay him like almost half as much. And yeah, he's not as experienced, and he doesn't get quite as much work done in the time period for the first little while as he learns the job. But I mean, it costs us a lot less money.
Yeah, there's no reward for the years of service and years of training and whatnot you have. And it does make a difference. You know, a lot of people think all we do is go for nice, pleasant strolls and throw things in boxes. But there are a lot of little things to the job, like there are to any other job, that actually add some value to it. And the corporation doesn't see that. They just see us all as you know, pack mules.
Yeah, I think it's somewhat sad, though, that despite all of those physical trials that people inside and outside at the post office go through, it feels more and more every day like the largest trial is just the interactions with management. Just going to work every day and dealing with the bullying and
they've abuses. Gone from being annoying to downright abusive in the last few months, and it's really out of control.
Yeah.
To the point where I think the union's going to take some far more serious action.
Yeah, well, I know at our facility, we're to the point where people don't do anything alone. You don't walk into the supervisor's office without a buddy.
It's beyond grievances at this point, and that's where we have to take it, I think.
Well, and it's to the point where people even feel that even if they are verbally or physically assaulted by a supervisor, they don't know that there's actually going to be any repercussions for the supervisor. And in some cases, we've seen members be the ones being punished, the victims being punished for being victims.
We had someone physically assaulted by a supervisor and suspended for 2 weeks for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean,
there's actually been 3 people out of our depot who have been assaulted in different ways in the last few months that have been suspended for being the victims.
Yeah, yep. I know. And it's kind of interesting to see this piece written by Chapman about how things were so violent at the time that he wrote it and how things are more diluted, later, but it feels like maybe it's that, at least in our case, it feels like there's still a lot of violence. It's just not us. So Chapman had a bit of history with labor before he wrote it. His father was a freight yard towerman, an active participant in the ARU railroad strike of 1894 in Chicago. And Chapman says he witnessed quite a lot of violence from the front porch of his home. And he speaks of conversations with Eugene Victor Debs, who kind of inspired him to write that. Debs appealed for a united strike action that would make violence unnecessary.
Yeah. Again, this was written in 1915 when violence on between unions and the employers were a fairly common way to handle labor disputes.
Another thing that he cites Debs as saying is that union officials are not the masters of the rank and file membership, but are its servants. So they estimate that that they're democratic, but that once they get into the higher positions, that maybe they lose some of that grassroots perspective.
We talked about this a lot when we did our episode on the strike at 65, where the leadership was almost working against the membership because they were worried about getting political jobs or moving up and switching over to the corporation into management later. A lot of corruption there when union rules weren't as formalized. Right. So it was a whole different world how the unions worked back then. They were kind of rogue elements almost.
I have a quote here from Chaplin's work that says, in my humble opinion, Debs and Haywood were both right in proclaiming that no one gains and everybody loses by getting masses of men to march shoulder to shoulder in the wrong direction. So basically, it's one thing to get people to follow you, but if you're not following them toward, or if they're not following you towards something that's for the betterment of all of the people in the group, why are they there?
Right. And that was really a distrust in union leadership as well as the corporation, because you never knew what the union leadership was really up to. And you still see that somewhat today. I know some people that think that the corporation is in, or the union is in cahoots with the corporation on all kinds of things. Conspiracy theory type stuff for the most part.
Did you come across this term scissor bills?
No, what's a scissor bill?
Okay, he defines the scissor bill was the belly aching element among the organized that would rather remain unorganized than do anything about it.
Just passive people then? Really?
So yeah, people who, I know this is going to step on some toes, but people who don't want to get involved in the union because it's just easier to be apathetic and just you know, go home and do whatever you need to do to get through the next week.
But again, this was in 1915 where being part of the union could get you targeted and you in physical danger. So
yeah.
I think it's a little more understandable back then when you kind of wanted to lay low, put your family at risk.
And you may have also heard of union leader Joe Hill, who's famous for being asked who are the leaders here in a labor action, and they responded by saying, "We are all leaders, and what are you going to do about it?" And when Joe was asked by a court judge to define the word scissor bill, Joe is reported to have replied, "The scissor bill, Your Honor, is an I guy, and we happen to be we guys."
Yeah.
So a person who's interested in their own advancement rather than the advancement of the entire labor force.
Which is useful today. We've had a demonstration at a depot a few years ago by a third party group, and the police were called at one point. That was the first thing the police wanted to know was who's in charge, because sometimes you can only charge the organizers, and their response was, well, we're a small democratic group with no leader, mm-hmm. and therefore the police couldn't charge nobody.
Right.
So something to keep in mind if you're ever going to do something that's legally questionable, but we're not encouraging anyone to break the law.
You have the right to gather and peacefully protest whatever you need to protest.
Yeah, but burning barrels on a city sidewalk
that's a violation.
Or literally on the sidewalk, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not allowed to have a fire on a city sidewalk. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it was entertaining. Okay.
So, of course, this is the Solidarity Forever, maybe the most widely known union or labor song, but there are a number of other songs that have varying popularity. They may also be called rebel songs, slave songs, songs of freedom, work songs, songs of dissent, songs of struggle, protest songs, liberation songs, labor songs, worker songs, industrial folk songs, environmental songs, songs of equality, and peace songs.
Just any kind of protest song against capitalism, really.
Totally. It kind of makes me laugh that in my searches I didn't come across Bob Marley's Songs of Freedom,
mm.
but I like that one actually a lot.
It's actually weird going back to the violent stuff. If you find some really old protest songs, some of them are quite violent about literally shooting or smashing or fighting your way out of something. And they mean it literally. They sound like war songs. Because, again, things were different then.
Right. Okay, so some famous ones are We Belong to the Union, subtitled You Can't Break Me, written in 1998 by Tim O'Brien. Joe Hill, written in 1938 by Alfred Hayes. Factory, 1978 by Bruce Springsteen. Which Side Are You On? Written in the 1930s by Florence Reese. Working Class Hero by John Lennon. There Is Power in a Union, written by Joe Hill in 1913, but popularized by Billy Bragg on his 1986 album Talking with the Taxman About Poetry. Also from the Little Red Songbook. Union Town in 2011 by Tom Morello. You can also see there's a number of songs on that album called World Rebel Songs. Take This Job and Shove It by Johnny Paycheck. I feel like that one's ripping off my, that's very close to the title of my If I Win the Lottery song that I'm going to perform at the Depot. I was going to say Stuff It, but Shove It is very close. Bread and Roses. Written by Mimi Farina and Judy Collins. And Union Burying Ground, 1941 by Woody Guthrie. And Company Store by Greg McPherson.
Yeah, they're not as common as they used to be. New songs, Great Big Sea, Process Man, I really like.
I've seen it titled as the Chemical Worker song.
I've seen that too, yeah. But yeah, Process Man is what it's called.
Oh, okay.
But if you YouTube it, either one I'm sure will work. Again, a lot of the old classics are in that Little Red Songbook. I just looked up on Amazon a minute ago. You can get it for $10 there.
I think we have some here at the Union office, actually.
So I'll put a link in the show notes to that version of the song that we played earlier, if I can still find it. I hope I didn't lose it. And if you're interested in any songs, or if you know of any songs that you think we should listen to, just send us a note to overburdenpod@gmail.com, and we will give those a listen before next week.